Okay.
This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. This is Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Innovative thoughts from baseball's best coaching minds from around the world. Brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. Now your host, former USA Baseball National Team Coach, Peter Caliendo.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Baseball Outside the Box. Thanks for joining us in the USA and around the world. We are thrilled that you can join us, and thank you so much. We have over 100 countries listening to the show, and we're thrilled about that. Don't forget, audio, Baseball Outside the Box, YouTube Live right now if you got any questions, and also that YouTube Live is Peter Caliendo, Facebook, Peter Caliendo also at his live. If you got any questions on Facebook, go ahead and type them in the chat box and we will get some questions to you. And don't forget, just do us one little favor. Everything's free. All the shows, YouTube, Facebook, everywhere that we do them, just subscribe. If you subscribe, boy, it really helps getting the show out. We really appreciate it. And folks, got to tell you, I was looking forward to this show. It is Sunday afternoon in Chicago, and we're talking about February 28, 2021, the first day of spring training games. I'm watching right there on TV. It's exciting. We were all looking forward to this. And here's the best part. There's fans in the stands. Now, I know it's limited, but it's fans in the stands. I know the players are excited, but more exciting than that is our guest. And I'll tell you why, because this gentleman, man, I was reading his website. Forget the baseball part. 35 years in the game, 16 at the big league level. He's got like four or five different clubs. I remember him in 1985 World Series. It's about the baseball part here. This guy's an unbelievable person. During his career, one of his main concerns, and I loved hearing this, was his family, about, you know, how he would spend time with his family, because it's tough as a big league player. But you're talking about a six-time Gold Glove, three-time All-Star. I mean, wow, World Series winner, catcher, toughest positions you can play. Let me just get to it because there's so much. He's also a broadcaster and author, so much to him. I want to get started with the discussion because I think it's going to be fascinating. Let me welcome Jim Sundberg. Jim, how you doing, man?
Good, Pete. Thanks. Great to be with you.
No, it's exciting and I love it. And, you know, I remember the 85 World Series. I mean, talk about a thriller. And I believe in the playoffs it was, if I remember right, and I think it was 85, you had an integral, you scored a winning run, I believe, in game seven, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it was games. Actually, it was the winning run in game six.
Six.
Winning run in game six, yes. And that took us to game seven, and just an exciting moment for not only myself, but Royal fans.
Was that at that time? Were you any part of the Royals Academy at that time? That was way before, right?
Yeah, that was way before. Actually, it was in the fall of '73 when Billy Martin at the Academy saw me for the first time and decided to make me the catcher of the Rangers the following year in '74. So I'm familiar with the Academy. But not as a Kansas City Royal, but from just viewing it from the outside.
Yeah, and I remember it because, you know, you got Willie Wilson at the time and all these guys that, you know, made it to the big leagues. Well, listen, folks, I'm going to just talk a little bit with Jim about catching. Only a few areas I think are critical. And then I want to get into the coaching part and the parenting part. I think that's the critical area. We're going to talk about your website and what you're doing and all that. The reason I want to start with the catching, because, you know, you're talking about all these years in the big leagues. I mean, you've got a lot that you can, you know, help our coaches with, you know, and I know times have changed. That's fine. There's different stances now, different things that people do, but I'm more interested in, you know, you're an all-star for, you know, six times. What were some of the things that you focused on as a catcher to make your skills the best they can be? What were you concerned with more than anything in those days?
Well, Pete, I was just gifted naturally defensively. I had a strong arm. I had quick feet. I had a quick release. And as time went by, as I was able to play more and more on an everyday basis, my accuracy got really good. There was a catcher or a scout that had scouted me in college. And when my first year in the big leagues, he sent me a letter with a scouting report. And he said, I thought you might enjoy this. It said on the report, I tend to believe he's a better catcher than he showed me today. He threw the ball in the center field three times. And so not always was I accurate, but I had the strong arm. I had the quick release, quick feet. And as time went by, I got real accurate with my, my throwing. But so I think natural ability is number one, and does a young catcher, young player want to actually catch? It just so happens too, that undiagnosed during my early years, I was ADHD. Oh. And so it made catching really good. In fact, when our daughter was diagnosed with it is when I found out about it myself. And are we okay there?
Yeah, we're good. We're good. We got folks ready on the call. You call in, ask you questions.
Yeah. And so, somebody's trying to get a hold of me.
That's all right. Take it if it's important.
No. And, I will, but the doctor that diagnosed my daughter said that's interesting, Jim, because 75% of the young boys I see in here are catchers. And so ADD or ADHD really happens to go along with catching. You have a lot of energy. You see a lot of things. You have a lot of perception that goes on naturally. And so that was an advantage for me. Especially the hyperactive, which allowed me to move about and play, I think, as many games as I did. I caught 1,400 games my first 10 years. And so it was something I enjoyed.
Well, you know, interesting enough, and folks, at 22, Jim made it to the big leagues with the Rangers, and he went from A-ball to the big leagues, which is incredible. You know, nowadays, Jim, the catching is really focused on receiving because of getting strikes called. And I'm sure it was important back then also. What were some of the techniques you may have used, you know, when they talk about framing? Was there something you did that you worked on to get calls, you know, so that way, you know, your pitcher got a better chance of, you know, getting strikes?
Well, I call it a 1 o'clock target. If my hand, if you put a clock up and it faces at in the web and out of here in this area, be at 1 o'clock, and this is a quarter turn, no matter which way I have to go. And so for me, receiving, and I think I was known for my receiving just as well as my throwing, mm-hmm. having soft hands and receiving the ball and holding the pitch where it's thrown. And so you're able to hold your hand out front. You're in a 1 o'clock target position. If you get your thumb too much turned this way in a target, then it's a disadvantage to try to get the glove counterclockwise around to catch a ball low inside to a right-handed batter. Mm-hmm. So the 1 o'clock target, I call it a 1 o'clock target, is really, and the glove is held out front. And that way you have the best leverage with it.
Like it. And you know, the other part of the game is calling games. You know, you didn't have the technology we have nowadays. Obviously they know everything. I mean, it's like they can figure out all. Those days you had charts and stuff, but how did you determine, you know, calling pitches? How did you know the hitters? How did you, you know, I know you had meetings possibly, but how did you review hitters and what did you look for in hitters, I guess?
Well, the first, you know, few years I kept a pretty large book because I was trying to get to know the leagues and get to know all the hitters in there. And so I was making a lot of notes. I did a lot of listening. And then as we started to play games, I began to understand a little bit of the game calling and what hitters' strengths and weaknesses were. But it took me a couple of years of good note keeping. I had Ferguson Jenkins, who was one of the a Hall of Famer and was one of the best pitchers that I've caught. I've caught 9 Hall of Famers. So I've had, and early on there was Gaylord Perry too. So I had some good guys to work with and work from and kind of learn. And so it kept keeping a book. And then as I learned the league, really what I wanted to know was who was hot and who was not. That's the biggest thing. Cause once I've got to know their strengths and weaknesses, I wanted to know who to avoid, trying to beat us in a key situation.
Were there times when, you know, when you, obviously you and the pitcher are normally on the same page, you work together a lot, but there may be times where, you know, a certain pitcher shakes you off.
Yeah.
Is it better to go with the pitcher because, you know, that he's throwing the pitch, or who determines that?
I've never been a fan of making a pitcher throw a pitch he doesn't want to throw.
Mm-hmm.
It's a combination. It's a team effort. I think once you get to working with a pitcher and you learn his and you get his trust and respect, then a lot of times he'll go with you. If there's not, and he shakes me off, a lot of times I'll just go with him in that situation. But we generally go over the hitters pretty well. And the longer you work with a guy, the better chemistry you have, and you kind of know where to go from there. I did catch Tom Candiotti. Yes. Before he started his knuckleball. And I have to say that he shook me off so many times. I had a guy in the dugout. I says, count how many times he shakes me off in the first five innings. And it was like 52 times. But he never stayed long in the big leagues at that point in time. Was sent back down and then came back when he had the knuckleball and he stayed for a little bit.
You know, and it's interesting because I was just about to ask you, you know, what type of pitcher is the toughest guy to catch? I would assume a knuckleball would be one of them. Any other that gave you troubles that you really had to, you know, focus a little harder?
Well, I caught Charlie Huff for quite a while and learned to catch the knuckleball, I think, pretty well, handle it well. But you even with that, it increases the pass balls because any good knuckleballer is going to throw some pitches that are absolutely so erratic and hard to catch. You try to stay in front of it, knock it down. And sometimes that's really impossible. But I would say of the non-knuckleball pitchers, Danny Jackson, a left-hander in Kansas City on the 85 staff, he threw two fastballs, one that cut and one that sank. And he wasn't sure at times which way it was going. And so it became hard to – and he had such a good break on both of those that it was like you had to really stay on your toes to catch both those pitches.
You know, and it's interesting because, say, two different pitches, but he didn't know what the ball was going to do. Because if he did know, I would assume that you would have two different signs for that.
That's right. And I think, you know, today they call it a two- and four-seamer. Mm-hmm. And but for him, it really had to do with whether he got his arm out front well enough or whether it was dragging a little bit. And so the ball, if he got his arm out front, the ball would cut. If it dragged a little bit, it would sink. And so it was one of those deals. I just had to be ready. I had to be on my toes.
You know, and I remember I was at Mickey on baseball school as a young kid, and Mickey had mentioned, you know, and way over my head because I didn't even know about it. But I think in 1942 or 49 within the World Series, you know, he dropped the third strike. And one of the reasons that he had mentioned that was tough because they didn't have two signs for that certain pitch. And he didn't know which one was coming and he got held up on it. But the other aspect of the game is that, and I want you to talk to, because we're going to get about talking to parents and coaches and especially volunteers in the game. Mm-hmm. I want you to talk to coaches, younger coaches, because I see it too much. And I see it too much at a lot of other levels too. And that is the umpire relationship that you have with a catcher or with players, the respect and all that. How did you deal with the umpires? Talk to, and how should people and coaches be dealing with the umpires?
Well, unfortunately, my first year and a half in the big leagues, I had Billy Martin as manager. And so he wanted me to be second guessing the umpire, and he wanted me to actually, if the pitch was a little bit outside, or close to a strike, he wanted me to say something to the umpire about that. And the relationship the first year and a half was not real good. I got to the point where I would rather have the umpire a little upset with me than when I got back to the dugout and have Billy yelling at me.
Yeah.
And so it took, I was actually kicked out of six games my first year and a half.
Wow.
But only two games my last 14 and a half. So after Billy stopped, was moved on to the Yankees, and we had different managers, it took me a couple of years to really smooth out the relationship. And it's really important to have that good rapport and that good relationship with the umpires, and it really does, I think, benefit you. Sometimes if there's close calls, it can go your way. I usually got to a point of being honest with them. even if they missed a strike that went against it, I would say, look, that pitch was really not a strike. It was a little bit outside, but I wouldn't do it when the batter was there. I would wait until he was gone. I would wait until there was a situation where I was alone, but I would try to be honest in both directions, whether it went for us or whether it went against us. I was, and so I got a reputation for being honest and only speaking when there was something that was going on in the game. So I think that relationship is really important. I don't think it should be aggressive and confrontational at all, but I think it always should be respectful.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of coaches call it the game of inches, and you know, certainly, and when it comes to, you know, being behind home plate, that inch helps a lot, and your rapport with the umpire can actually get you some calls, and I certainly understand that. Did you do anything different in your stance to try to get calls? Nowadays, you see a lot of catchers, they're going really low, the kind of that Manny Sanguin kind of stance sometimes, the one knee or the leg out, and they're trying to get real low. Did you do anything like that to try to give the umpire a better shot at?
Mainly just trying to catch the ball out front. If I could catch the ball out as far as out front, I could see as I could and try to elevate it, catch and elevate a little bit, the low pitch that allows the umpire to see it. You know, jumping up or moving up it really affects him. So really staying down as low as you could and staying in a position where you're catching the ball and you're actually holding, lifting the ball up a little bit, that allows the umpire to get a good look at that low pitch.
Was there anything, you know, being a catcher, man, all these years, I mean, tough on your body, you're talking about all these games that you caught. Was there anything you did to kind of recuperate? You're playing every day, but anything you did to kind of recuperate your body after you played, or did you just go back to sleep and then wake up and get ready again?
It was really tough in Texas because it was really the hottest place with the old stadium that was kind of wide open, and the sun was on you into the first couple of innings of the game. And so, but a lot of times I would have a full sweat by the second inning, and because we had wind, it actually worked as a little bit of a refrigerator effect on me. With the uniform being totally wet and getting a breeze, it really worked well. So from a game standpoint, the wind really helped. I try to get enough rest and eat well and take care of myself. And that's basically it. I mean, it's a full-time effort to try to do that.
Well, absolutely. I can see it. I mean, that's something I tried at one time when I was a young kid. And I said, that's not for me. I'm going to a different position. I said, I have so much respect for catchers and what they go through. And, you know, they seem to also become very good managers and coaches because, you know, you can't help but study the game. You have to, right?
That's right. Yeah, there's been a lot over the years that have catchers that become managers. And I think it just kind of fits. You're used to kind of running the game behind home plate. You're used to knowing the different positions. You know how to move infielders and outfielders. You've got to deal with different personalities on the mound, and so it really works well to you know and have a great understanding of the game. It's a quarterback. It's a quarterback position in baseball.
You know, that could be a whole story. Actually, it could be a whole podcast when you talk about dealing with pitchers, because pitchers are so different in a lot of ways, and every pitcher is a little different. I'm sure you have great stories there you could talk about that when you had to deal with certain pitchers. Here's how I kind of want to lead this in now, because we're going to lead into the parenting part and the coaching aspect. To the parents and coaches that are working with young kids, there you go, perfect lead-in, young kids.
My granddaughter says she's hungry.
Absolutely, I can't blame her. I think I'm hungry too. You know, and it leads into, talk to our parents a little bit, and you know, young coaches that are working first time with catchers, so just some advice, kind of, you know, so they're not so tough on them, because it is such a tough, you know, position.
Well, you know, I think, you know, starting from, you know, getting good equipment and having the kind of equipment that work for a catcher, the right size of equipment, getting a good glove, one that's not too heavy. from that standpoint. But also, I look at it as a relationship where you're talking back and forth, and you're giving instruction, and you're respecting each other. I mean, I think it's important to respect the young catcher that's out there. No one likes to get yelled at. I never like to get yelled at, and so it's so important for young coaches with young catchers to work on that relationship. It's probably the most important relationship that he's going to have on the field. It's the one where he's going to have the most dialogue with. And so to be able to have respect going back and forth and taking time out when they get back in the dugout to talk over situations and to discuss what actually just happened in the particular game. But it's a respectful interchange with each other.
Absolutely. Folks, we're talking to Jim Sundberg, six-time Gold Glove winner, World Series champion, author, broadcast for the Texas Rangers many years. And we want to now lead into, I think this is kind of at my heart. This is what I believe in. I've always believed that the foundation of our sport, whether people like it or not, I know there's great coaches at high school and travel ball, high college and pro ball and all that, but the foundation of it is our parents. Those are the volunteers. It's the biggest, by the way, folks, we say it on the show all the time. It's the biggest coaching organization, but it's not organized, but it's the biggest coaching organization in the world. Because if you number the high school, college and pro coaches, it doesn't even come close to volunteer coaches. That's the foundation of the sport. You wrote a book, How to Win, and talked about how to win at sports parenting. Talk about the book. The website, folks, is jimsundberg.com. That's easy. I encourage you to go there. It's awesome. But talk about, you know, why you wrote the book and why parenting and coaching is so important.
Well, you know, Pete, when I always kind of wanted to write a book. And when I went to a publisher with an idea of writing a book, he said, you know, really, the parents are wanting to know how to parent in sports. He says, can you address that? And I said, well, sure enough, my wife and I can do that. We've had three competitive children who played select sports, and we learned how to navigate that. And so How to Win in Sports Parenting is really a holistic effort on how to handle the home situation, how to encourage children, how to kind of stay out of the way a little bit. There was a survey I did one time with 15 Ranger players, and in that survey, what I found out that all but one of the 15 had parents that drove them to and from the game, and most of them didn't get involved in the game, which included Buddy Bell's dad. And also later on, we interviewed girls on the USA gold medal softball team. I think it was, I'm trying to remember the name, but I don't remember the year of it now. But of the girls that we talked to then, only four of the 18 girls that were on that club that won the gold medal had parents that actually knew about their particular sport. If the child doesn't have the ability, doesn't have the drive on their own, it's going to be hard to navigate the sports scene. There's going to be a lot of pressure, a lot of tension. If you're a dad coach, I use a trick called the hat trick, a hockey term. And that means that if you're coaching, you got your hat on, you're coaching, instructing, you're disciplined. And then on the way home in the car, you take your hat off and you become the parent, the nurturing, encouraging side of that. And it's not a good thing to be talking sports 24/7 during the game, on the way home, at home, all around the house. There's a time where kids need a break, and especially with as many games as kids are playing today.
Yeah, and talk about that, because you brought that ride home. You hear it a lot. Talk about that ride home. What does that conversation look like? And who initiates it? Is it the kid or is it the parent?
Well, I think that the parent does. I mean, the parent actually will feed off of what the the kid, if the young athlete wants to talk about it, you can go ahead and talk about the game. But I think for the most part is you can use that time to talk all the things that the child did well that day. He hustled. He had some good at bat. He had good at bats. He swung well at the pitch. You know, you got your hands out front while you're when you're fielding. You read the ball well off the bat that was hit to the outfield. So there's a lot of different things you can say in a positive way. And then if there's something negative, you can wait and hold it to the next day. I mean, you don't have to necessarily bring that up unless the child does, but the child is real sensitive to that anyway. One of the things that if you're at a game, one of the things that happens, if a child makes a mistake, one of the first, especially the younger they are, that one of the first things they do is they look in the stands and they look for mom and dad to see how they're responding. And so we tell parents, don't go to your face or don't look up in the sky when your kids, and of course the parents feel a little shame at the moment.
Right.
Their heart is on the field with the child. Yeah. And it's as if they just made the mistake. And so so we say, you know, keep your hands down and be aware of the children when they look in the stands and be encouraging.
You know, it's interesting. My parents come from Italy. Now, they didn't know the game a lot. My dad loved the game. He liked watching it. And, you know, my grandmother from Italy thought it was always fixed. They said, oh, they already know the score ahead of time. And, you know, so that was an interesting conversation.
But I love Italy.
Yeah,
I've been to Italy 4 or 5 times now.
That'd be awesome country.
Yeah.
You know, as off the air, you and I talked. You know, I was raised there for 4 years, and my first language was Italian.
Yeah.
You know, my parents, when I was in Little League playing, they understood. They must have understood the pressure, even though they didn't know the game. They really never told me when they would come and where they were at. They would kind of stand aside because they didn't want me to see them, because they thought that would put more pressure on them. That really helped me a lot, because I remember being a young kid, there was so much pressure already. And then if I knew my parents were there, there was even more pressure just because they're there, because I want to do so well for them.
Mm-hmm.
So now let's talk about, because no matter what, there's going to be failure. We all know that in the game of baseball. It's the game you fail most of any game. And what happens now if I'm in the car or after a ball game and I say to my, you know, father or mother in the car, you know, I struck out 3 times, you know, and I missed the ground ball. And I bring up the negative aspect of what happened. What do you tell the youngster in that situation?
Well, I first of all, you bring up a great point, because there's no pro sport that you can be an all-star and mess up 70% of the time. I mean, an NBA basketball player cannot shoot 30% of the time. A quarterback can't throw 30% of the time. I mean, it's a great point, and there is a lot of failure on that. And we keep saying one game, one at bat is not a failure. You bounce back. You learn to actually, as you move up through sports, by the time you get to the big leagues, you learn to minimize the negative part of the game. You struck out, then you move on, and it's embedded. And by the time you get there, so. I think as a parent, you try to minimize the negative aspect of the game. Okay, yeah, you struck out 3 times. I did 2 one time, and it hurt. But you're going to be okay. You got another game tomorrow, and the big part of baseball is to put the past behind you, and kind of look forward to the next day. I think the parent's response, if it's a caring, nurturing type of response, one that sympathizes a little bit, then it's a lot easier for the child to make a mistake and not be so hard on himself.
You know, I love earlier what you said. You talked about, you know, bringing up the positives, because again, it's easy to bring up a lot of negatives, but if you're bringing up some positive things, and there's so many positive things, it could be hitting, base running, like you said, fielding, so many things you can do right during a game. We always tend to focus on the pitching and the hitting, but there's so much. There's base running. You can talk about how well you did that. Now, the difficult part, and this is what I want to ask you about, and I want to give a shout out. First of all, there's a lot of people on Facebook. Gary Lefebvre from Arizona, Team USA coach. Great guy. Great coach. As a matter of fact, with the Arizona High School Coaches Association, he's the head of it. you've got the parent and you got the coach now, right? Especially at the youth levels. I always felt the communication is so important between three people, the player, the coach, and the parent. I get it that there's that fine line between, you know, a parent coming to say, hey, how come my son or daughter's not playing and all that? But at the same time, that youngster is going to go home with their dad. And I think I speak to dads mostly on this, because they're going home with dad. And dad, if he doesn't like what the coach is doing, is going to might even say something and will teach something different. There has to be some communication, and it's a delicate issue. What's your recommendation there on how to deal with the parents and the coaches on that communication?
Okay, first of all, I from a coach to the parent, we determined and really had a lot of great feedback on this when we were after we wrote our book, and that basically was that if the coach lays the foundation out to all the parents in the beginning of the year, here's what we're going to do, here's what we're not going to do, this is the way I'm going to run a game, this is what you can do during the season, here's what I'm not going to listen to during the season. So if you lay out the groundwork, then the season goes a whole lot better with that. It's a great question when you've got a coach and, you know, I played for 16 managers in 16 years in the big leagues, and two of them twice. Wow. And that didn't include the ones I played all along the way. And you're going to run into some coach that thinks you've got to do it a way that you don't necessarily want to do it. And obviously, as you get older, it's a lot easier to have a communication with the manager or the coach and say this and give him your reasons why you're doing it this way. But from a young standpoint, and you got a dad that says, hey, feels like he knows a little bit better than the coach. The dad can kind of gently come up alongside the coach and have a conversation with him about it. But I think ultimately what's going to happen is the coach is going to probably have his way, and you kind of deal with it. I think it's a good way to teach kids that not always are you going to be able to have like-mindedness with someone that's over you, that you're going to have to learn to make some adjustments, and you might have to just bide your time and until you're able to do it the way you want to do it.
No, and I'm glad you brought that up, because nowadays, big change in the game at the youth levels. You know, as you know, I mean, we got travel teams at 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, so young. But one of the concerns I have, and we realize, and I think science has proven it, you know, no young kid should be playing baseball all year round for many factors, not just health factors, but also burnout and some other things. Before we get into some of that, the other part of this is, you know, if a kid is playing for the same coach for 5 years in a row, 6 years in a row, he doesn't get, or she doesn't get that ability to understand how you deal with different coaches and what you just said. So being with one team at 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12 only, I think can be a detriment. What's your thoughts?
Well, obviously if you have some issues with a coach in one particular year and it didn't straighten itself out, I don't recommend staying in that situation. And so I think the ones that I've seen where the kids are with a coach 3, 4, 5, 6 years through U Sports, that generally the coach and the parents have a pretty good rapport. But it's only in situations where you have difficulty, and you could get in the middle of that. Let's say you get in the middle of 3 years and all of a sudden you got some issues that you can't get past, then it's probably time to move on. I don't recommend staying in a bad situation for more than a year. I think if it's a bad situation, sometimes that's all it takes to get a child where he doesn't want to play anymore. So I think you have to be sensitive to coaches that say there's the right way, the wrong way, and my way, or the highway. Then I think a parent has to be very sensitive to that.
You know, back to the parent too, you know, what about, you know, it's a responsibility of a player any age. you know, if you're not doing real well in fielding or hitting or whatever the situation may be, you got to practice a little bit, right? You can't just always go to practice, expect practice and the coach to make you better. The coach is there to help you out, especially at the volunteer level, because they don't practice a lot. So what about a parent, your recommendation of a parent working with their kids at home, helping them out, ground balls, hitting, whatever it may be, you know, even just rolling ground balls, doing something, having a parent part of that situation. It's better if they're obviously communicating with the coach so the kid's not getting confused on what you're trying to work on.
Right. And I think any child loves the participation of a parent when they come home, either from work or whenever it is. I know for a fact, you know, in my own situation, I lived across from a ballpark and I played in the park all day long with my buddies. And then dad was a letter carrier and he'd get home about 3 o'clock. And it was back to the field. If I was home, it was back to the field, and he would throw batting practice for however long I wanted to really hit. And so those are memories that I'll never forget that that really instill a sense of self-esteem when your parents take an interest in your sport and decide to help out a little bit. And but on the other hand, they, as I said earlier, they don't have to get so intense in it that it becomes their sport and not their kid's sport. And that's when pressure builds up, tension builds up, and the home is not a fun place for the child to go. But as long as the father decides to take an interest in the children and play, I think that's always really good.
Absolutely. What about now parents that are, you know, are thinking about getting the coaching, you know, what's your advice there? How to start, you know, what's some advice on, you know, it might be the first time that they're coaching baseball. They might see baseball on TV and they might have played it in high school or college, but you know, as you and I think a lot of people understand, playing it and coaching it are two different ball games.
It really is. I think you need to get there. There's a lot of good informational instructional stuff out there to get, especially today, and to look at if you're just started. I actually toyed with a product called Practice Planner years ago, and it was to keep a dad organized in a practice session. Yep. And I kind of let that go, and end up getting back to baseball. But I think in a practice session, you want to try to keep it as fun as you can and to play games. Play hitting games, play fielding games. Anytime that you can have a game and learn fundamentals is a great way to go about being a coach. If you keep it fun for the kids, you practice fun, you'll be a good coach.
Yeah, by the way, I'm looking here. It just happened to be on the Coach's Pocket Planner by Whitey Herzog.
Yeah.
I just happened to have it on the table here. I don't know why. It was just here a long time. I guess I need to read this.
I remember that from years ago.
Yeah, this goes back a while.
Yeah.
They sold over 50,000 copies.
Yeah. Wow. But you know, it's fundamentals are the same. They don't really change, proper fundamentals, whether it's hitting, fielding, throwing, base running. It generally stays pretty much the same. It's the conditioning that really has changed. It's practice that's changed in a lot of ways.
Jim, in your book, what do we miss here? What some important topics I didn't bring up, something important for parenting when it comes to, you know, the sport of baseball?
Well, one of the sections in there, one of the creative sections of it, I did 8 game day parent personalities. And it was for the parent to help process his emotions during the game, because a lot of times the emotions get out of hand. And I had Analytical Alice, who is really psychologist supreme. She kind of checks everybody out and she sits there. She didn't really bother anybody. And there's Dutiful Debbie, who would rather be watching a TV show or a movie, but she's there watching with her kids. So all these personalities go through. Rambunctious Randy, Passive Paul, Smoking Sam,
that's all
Bill Vance. I mean, there are 8 parent personalities that you see at every game. I took 5 years when I was watching my kids, my girls play volleyball, and I got creative with the way parents process their emotions during the game. And so it's a chapter that I deal with how parents can better deal with their emotions during a game, especially when it tends to get out of hand. Because we're all, from a very early point, we're trying to get our parent sports legs. We really are, and it takes some time to really learn to process those emotions.
Yeah, you know, if you haven't really been involved like that as a parent, it's really tough to understand it, because we do know, as you said earlier, you know, you're sitting in the stands, when you see your youngster failing, that drives you nuts, because if you feel like, you know, your heart's being torn out because you want them to do so well. So it's understandable, but understanding how to deal with that pressure that you're in the stands, that's the difficult part, and that's the part that you're showing in your book.
Yeah, and the number one emotion that most people have during a game is shame. Something happens on the field, a strikeout, or it happens a couple of times, an error that the child makes at the wrong time, something where there's a mistake made, and the parent will find out very quickly just how they've processed that same thing in their own life. And the more that a parent can be able to process it for themselves, they can help the child process how to deal with a failure. Failure is not a person. A strikeout's not a person. A loss isn't a person. It's just one day. It's one day at the park, one game, one time at the plate, one moment in the field, and downplay the size of it.
You know, a lot of parents are coaches, so that's a double whammy, because now you're in the dugout, you know, and now your son or daughter is not doing well, and you're right there with them. That can be real tough. So talk about how to deal with that aspect of it.
Well, it is, because I think the coach probably has more pressure on them, because they're thinking, well, I'm the coach and my kid should really know better how to play it. And so the coach has to model it better than any parent. He's the number one modeler of that on the field. And if he can't do that, or she can't do that, then there's going to be the team is going to have trouble processing, and the parents are going to have trouble processing mistakes. So if the coach has to lead the way, and especially with his own child, he can't be extra hard on his own child, which some of them tend to be, because of this sense of shame when a mistake is made.
I've heard a lot of coaches talk about, you know, they won't coach their own kid in a game. They'll let the assistant coach or another coach work with, you know, their son or daughter. That makes sense?
Yeah. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. Again, it comes down to the relationship. If the parent, it's going to be led by the parent. If the parent's emotions are under control and can be handled, then it's possible that it could work. But it does come down to who is going to be patient, who's going to be understanding, who can give comfort. I say give comfort at times when comfort is needed, whether it's a strikeout or an error. So that's an important thing. And kids know. Kids really have an understanding of who they can go to when something bad happened.
Boy, and you said it, keyword patience, because this game can turn you upside down in a second. When things are going well, all of a sudden things change and they're not going as well. Folks, we got about 12 minutes to go here with Jim. If you got any questions, but a lot of people on Facebook, thank you. You know, Michael Jordan always said, I'm paraphrasing, that, you know, he failed so much when he was younger. That's really what made him really good later on. But yet, if you look at, and look, I'm included in this. If you look at parents and coaches sometimes, we try to put them in a position to succeed so much that later on, they don't know how to deal with the failure. So talk about that, you know, to the parents that, look, they've got to fail. It's going to happen. So let it happen sometimes, but you got to deal with it.
Yeah, we have seen in situations, and when I say we, I'm speaking now from front office, Major League Baseball front office standpoint, where you get a first round draft pick who has had success all the way along the way. And all of a sudden he gets to a higher standard, a higher competition, and he doesn't do well, and then he doesn't know how to handle it, and it becomes even worse. It becomes a mental game at that point. There's been kids that have fallen to the wayside, and there are extra efforts being made today in scouting to actually get to know parents and to get to see a little bit of their attitude and where they're coming from, and so that they can better know the kid that's getting ready to be drafted. And especially when you're making high draft picks, you don't want to make mistakes. And so so anyway, it's an interesting dynamic that goes on in pro sports, that that people are watching, looking at parents, trying to also see what kind of parenting goes on with that child.
Yeah, you know, I was just thinking as you mentioned that there's a lot going on at the youth levels nowadays. Is there something that kind of bothers you where the game's heading at the grassroots level, whether it be coaching or parenting or you know, number of games they're playing, anything like that, that you think we got to be real careful that we may be heading in the wrong direction? Because, we're, you know, our goal is what? Is to keep these kids in the game as long as possible, right? Mm-hmm. Making it fun, making them individually better so that way they mm-hmm. enjoy the game. So is there something that you're concerned about?
I think you have to watch the game load for kids under 12. I think that's really important. When I hear that a 10-year-old is playing 100 games in a year, I'm thinking burnout. I'm thinking their body can't really process that many games. You know, through the age of 12, I played 15 organized games, but I played every day in the ballpark with the friends. And when you're playing that many games, the stressor is on the pitchers. You know, the medical people for the Texas Ranger baseball, the orthopedic people, talk about not throwing more than 100% pitches in a week. And I think that's the biggest that's the biggest thing that we see today, is the number of kids that have overpitched in games before the age of 14 and hurt their arms. Our medical staff gave me an article a few years back that was in Sports Illustrated. And it's an interesting article because it had a pitcher hitter breakdown, and the pitchers were from the north and the hitters were from the south. And the reason the pitchers were from the north is because it was a shortened season and they didn't really have a chance to get a lot of games and get hurt. And so that was really a telling story about if you're in the south and you're playing a lot of games, that you've got to be very careful about how many innings you put on a young kid's arm.
Yeah, great point, because we are seeing a lot of injuries and guys are throwing harder too. Or, you know, they might even be going, you know, too young to weighted balls. They're not ready for it. There's so many things that are changing in the game. The other concern is, and you mentioned, you know, south and north, there's a lot of showcases that are during the Christmas time. Well, I live here in Chicago. Well, you know, pitchers aren't ready to pitch at a showcase in Florida that coming from the north. That's a big concern, and we got to be really careful with that. I mean, what's your thoughts?
No, it would be the same thing. It's kids that are in the north going to the south and they hadn't thrown for a while. It's still an arm situation. You got to be very careful. And to do something like that and do it effectively, they've got to continue to throw in the north to be prepared for the game in the south. And so it's one of those things. I know that a lot of coaches at the major league level that I have been around, not let their kids pitch until the age of 14. And the growth plates are still active and they're working. And after the age of 14, then they can put more stress on the arm. Parents have got to be very careful about a child taking a month, 2 months off, and then going down and all of a sudden trying to throw in the 90s at a game where scouts are going to be at. It's very dangerous.
And that's why I brought up, you know, the most important level is a grassroots level parent coach, because it's important that they're more educated than anything. I understand it's not their full-time job, but, you know, organizations like USA Baseball and others in the U.S. are trying to educate as many parents as possible because the more educated they are, the less issues we will have in what you're talking about. So I encourage everybody to, you know, get Jim's book. We're going to put it on the website. The other aspect of this that I was writing down, we know the answer to this, but I want to ask you this thing. Up till high school baseball, how many sports did you play?
I basically played three. I played three sports, and then finally I went to playing two. But when I gave up football after junior high, I went to cross country. So I did cross country, I did basketball, and I did baseball. I didn't play one sport all year long. I played multiple sports. It just is good for an athlete to do that.
And talking about that now, you got football. Talk about what that did for you. What could you know, football do for you for baseball? What could other sports do for you?
Well, I actually hurt my arm in ninth grade year trying to make a tackle. And my dad wisely said, you know, after that, you're not going to play football, and it's just going to be, we're going to go to basketball and baseball. And I went out to cross country just to be ready for basketball. And so there was a conditioning point for basketball. And then, but the main sport, we knew all along, the main sport was going to be baseball, but I only played it 3 months out of the year.
You know, and I bring that up because, you know, we keep talking about let young kids play out multiple sports. So that way their body develops all the different skills, whether it be toughness, right, whether it be ability, all that stuff. It's good for you. Hey, let me, I will take a question and you could add to anything you like, Jim. We got about, looks like eight more minutes or seven more minutes. Chris Fanta, great friend of mine, also a super agent. He had a question, toughest pitcher you faced during your career and your favorite pitcher to catch.
The toughest pitcher no one remembers, Mark Parrott from Seattle. He was a sinker ball pitcher, right-handed sinker ball pitcher. He threw the ball inside part of the plate on my hands all the time. And I don't know if I ever got a ball past the pitcher's mound on this guy. I mean, it's amazing the guys that you can't hit. And my lifetime BA against Baltimore was 301, and they had a great pitching staff. But Mark Parrott, the nine Hall of Famers that I've caught, Ferguson Jenkins was the best, the easiest, the most fun to catch.
Why?
He had great control. I didn't have to move much. You know, if you've got a pitcher throwing 95 and he's throwing one ball down and away, and the next one down and in, and then up and away, it's hard to reach those pitches that are going 95 miles an hour. So when you got somebody that's around the plate, throws strikes, we got into good sequences together, he just made catching easy. It was just one of those things. We could do an hour and 45-minute game is what Fergie would throw, a two-hour game. It's like having the night off compared to a three-and-a-half-hour game.
And I remember being at Make-Your-Own-Baseball school. I think I umpired about 85 games a year. How about how nice it is on the umpire? It's a lot easier to call that game when you're around the strike zone.
It is, and umpires – like when guys are around the plate, and they give them more strikes. They even give a guy that throws strikes more strikes.
Absolutely.
And the opposite is true. A guy that is all over the plate, sometimes the umpire misses a strike.
Yeah, you could see, because sometimes they'll set up inside and the guy misses outside, even right, though it was a strike. Right. The umpire didn't have a chance to see that.
Right, exactly. And you can see, by the way, the umpire's setting up, he's not really prepared to look at that pitch outside.
Right, and we think that, you know, they're just going to – they can see the ball that fast, move their head, and it's just not going to happen. It can ball come so right, quick. Folks, Jim Sundberg, .993 career fielding average. Incredible. And then you wonder why he was, you know, six-time a gold glove and a three-time all-star. Batting average, .248, 95 home runs. You know, just a great, great, great catcher. Hey, Jim, this has been awesome. I want you to kind of close it off, you know, because it's more important about your website, the book, what you do, personally, you know, I know you do a lot of speaking, but a lot of it's probably been virtual now. So I want to really let the folks know, because there's so many interesting things here. You talked about, I read about legacy matters, expand your vision, increase legacy. I mean, that's a whole new topic in itself we could talk about. So give the folks a little more.
Well, the latest book is Legacy Playbook. And so it's really more of the book that I wanted to write most of my life. It's a life story about having a father that actually pushed hard. He played the game through me. He wanted to try to have a chance to play and never did. And I talk about some of the difficulties that I went through on that, and some of the issues of an overbearing parent, and some of the cycles that I went through because of that, and how I came out of it. It's a great book. It's 50 days of encouragement on what matters most. And so I do a blog. I also have a blog. You can go on to jimsundberg.com and sign up for the subscribe for the blog. And my time is spent doing actually writing and spending time with grandkids. I've had some that have come through playing sports. We're always involved in sports, and it doesn't take too long to get caught up on actually things that are happening around baseball, around the major leagues.
Yeah, and what's great is that you've been through a lot of things, and you can really relate that to the parents and the coaches, especially what you just talked about. When you just mentioned this about, you know, your father, the first thing that came to my mind was Jimmy Pearsall. I remember there, you know, so, and there's so many parents that go through that and their kids, and it's a tough situation. So folks, I encourage you, jimsundberg.com, go to it. As a matter of fact, you go to it, all everything Jim's talking about is right on the website. We will send it out. We'll set it up on the show notes. Jim, I need you to get to your grandkids, because I know your granddaughter's hungry.
Yeah, she's hungry.
I can't thank you enough, folks. Just okay, so you know, Pete,
thank you.
Jim and I have never met, and he was so gracious to do this. Thank you. God bless you. And
right, especially, thank you, Pete.
Thank you very much, Jim.
All right.
Jim, that is Jim Sundberg. Also, special thanks to Brian Crocker, producer with the Lineup Media Group. And also, a thank you to everybody on Facebook, on YouTube. Just do us a favor. It's all we ask. Go to YouTube, Peter Caliendo, subscribe. That really helps get the show out. We really need your help in doing that. And then if you can, go to Baseball Outside the Box. That's where the audio part's at. The video's on YouTube. Go to the audio part, hit subscribe there too. That would really help us out. Thanks, folks, in the U.S. and around the world for joining us, Facebook, YouTube, on Baseball Outside the Box. This is a show that loves to interview baseball's best coaching minds who love to challenge the status quo. I'm your host, Pete Caliendo. I wish you to stay healthy, safe. God bless you, and we'll see you on the next show.